I'm thrilled to say that this series of Beyond the Bathroom is sponsored by Skin & Me, the subscription skincare service tailored to provide what your skin needs. Make sure to keep listening for a discount code you won't want to miss. That's for later in the episode. Now on with the show. Hi, I'm Sally Hughes and this is Beyond the Bathroom, where each week I chat to my guests about their relationships with their own appearance. In Beyond the Bathroom, I attempt to get under the skin of my guests' beauty routines and rituals and hope to find out exactly what they see when they look in the mirror. How has their past affected the way they see themselves now? When did they look and feel their best? And how has their relationship with face and body shifted as life has ebbed and flowed? Today's guest is Afua Hirsch. Afua is a writer, broadcaster, and author. Not to mention documentary maker, co-founder of a fashion brand, and former barrister. She was born in Norway to a British father and Ghanaian mother before the family moved to southwest London. Growing up mixed race in the predominantly white environs of Wimbledon exposed Afua to assumptions not only about race, but about class and gender. Her reflections on our national attitudes towards these issues led in 2017 to her best-selling and succinctly titled book, Brit-ish, on race, identity and belonging. In 2020, New African magazine included Afua in its list of top 100 most influential Africans, while in the Power List 2021, she was named as the ninth most influential person of African or African Caribbean heritage in the United Kingdom. Afua has also come to public attention for challenging the reputations of mainstream historical British heroes, including highlighting the less savoury aspects of Winston Churchill's beliefs and floating the idea of removing Nelson's column. What is lesser known is that she is also a fashion and beauty enthusiast, which is one of the many reasons she's here today. Afua, welcome. Thank you so much for coming. So happy to have you here. Been trying to get you on for ages, thrilled we could make it work. There's so much you've talked about in the past about how it felt growing up where you grew up. Wimbledon, not the most diverse of areas. Tell me when you first became aware of how you looked, and I suppose by extension, how other people felt you looked.
I guess I could answer that differently from what people have told me. My mother tells a story about how when my sister was born, when I was 4 and a half, and there are just the two of us, apparently when I saw her, my reaction was one of complete shock. And I said, she looks like me. She's the same colour as me. And that was the first moment my mum says it occurred to her that I was so conscious that I looked different from everyone around me. And that actually I'd barely ever seen anyone the same complexion as me, because my mother's a black woman from Ghana, my dad's white. As you said, Wimbledon now, but especially then, was not a diverse place. And I think there are really two things about the atmosphere in Wimbledon, and it is a beautiful place. I actually still live there. So, you know, it was a huge privilege to grow up in somewhere so leafy and safe and family friendly. But I would say the two things really that affected my relationship with my appearance were, one, not seeing people who looked like me or who looked like our family, a kind of interracial family at all. And the second was a more subtle atmosphere, I think, of assimilation, that those people who did exist in my environment from ethnic minority backgrounds never spoke about it, never self-identified openly as having another cultural or racial hinterland or belonging. It was this atmosphere of just trying to fit into the pre-existing cultural norms around family, around race, around beauty, around food. So I think from a young age, I got this sense that whatever was different about us should just be avoided and ignored. And I think actually in terms of my relationship with my own appearance and culture, that was probably the harder thing. Because eventually you do meet other people who look like you and have a similar background. But those ideas about what's desirable, about success being assimilating into kind of middle class Britishness and whiteness, those take much longer to identify, I think, in your own psyche and to really challenge.
I think lots of people maybe assume that being in a minority group makes you visible and othered and picked out. But actually, I was so interested in something I read of yours a long time ago. I think it's in your book, actually, when you say that actually people's response to your skin colour
and your heritage was to kind of pretend it didn't exist, right? And to make it invisible, to erase it, because that was more comfortable for everyone. Can you tell me about that? Because I believe that was a really young memory. That was a school memory.
And that's, I think, the cognitive dissonance of race. It doesn't make sense.
Yeah, it doesn't.
So on the one hand, you are constantly getting these little microaggressions or otherings that remind you you're different. People talking about your hair, in my case, making fun of my hair. You know, it didn't flop down like my friend's hair. You know, it had a volume. It had gravity-defying abilities. That was something that, at the time, I just wanted to go away. I just wanted to look like everyone else. You know, comments about my skin. Why didn't I burn in the sun? Why did I need to put moisturizer on every day? Even as a child, you know, you would never bath or shower without religiously creaming your skin. Otherwise, it's going to go ashy. So my name being a Ghanaian name, all these things that constantly remind you you're othered. But I think the prevailing culture in Britain as a whole at the time was this discomfort with race, that people wanted not to see it. And so whilst othering me on the one hand, they would also say, well, we don't see race. We're all the same. These ideas that we've all absorbed in society about race, but we haven't understood. So my school friends once said to me, and I remember this, and this is what I wrote about in the book, don't worry, Af, we don't even see you as black. You're fine.
Yeah.
And they thought they were telling me that I was welcome, that I was one of them. They thought that that was an inclusive message. What it did was tell me that they perceived there being something wrong with blackness, that blackness was undesirable, and that in their eyes, the best thing that could happen to me was to assimilate away from it.
To overlook it.
To overlook it, to outgrow it, to overcome it, like it's a problem. And for me, the issue was that, and this is something I'm so grateful for, I had a Ghanaian family. You know, my mother's a black woman. I have a whole family of Ghanaians, and especially Ghanaian women. Ghana's actually a matrilineal society. It's very rare in the world where you inherit through your mother's line. So what you are is, in Ghana, dependent on who your mother is, not who your father is. So in the Ghanaian worldview, I am a Ghanaian because my mum's a Ghanaian.
Similar to Jewish.
It's like the Jewish idea. And also a country where women are very dominant, and there's a very strong matriarchal trend. So I also knew that my relationship with my own blackness was actually a very joyful one. I have this amazing family and this amazing culture and this food that I love. And I don't see it as something I want to move away from. I don't see it as something I want you to overlook. And why was it that the people around me couldn't understand that?
And did you know that then? Were you able to rationalize that thought for yourself then, or were you just wounded? I can't imagine how one might react to that when little.
This whole experience in my childhood was something I felt very deeply but couldn't articulate. And that's one of the reasons I suppose became the adult who found the language and wrote this book, because there wasn't even a language for it. I didn't know the language of assimilating, othering, microaggressions, racial discomfort, none of this, systemic racism. I didn't know anything about the history of empire. It wasn't part of our education. Even my mum, who grew up in the empire, was taught a very colonial British education.
Of course.
So we were also being raised by people who were at the front line of this, but also hadn't been educated about it, didn't have a language for it. So I really felt like I was having to work it out for myself. And I think we underestimate what children perceive. And in my case, actually, it was slightly complicated as well by the fact that my father's of Jewish heritage. And so on both sides of my family, I have this immigrant story. And my grandfather, my dad's dad, was a refugee from Nazi Germany. And he came to Britain as an unaccompanied child refugee in 1939. He spoke no English. He had no money. He had no connections to Britain.
Same as my father-in-law, exactly the same story.
And it's quite a common story. And that generation were just remarkable. He learnt the language, changed his name, assimilated into Britishness.
Yeah.
By that, I mean, by the time my father was born, I don't think anyone ever asked my dad or his siblings, why are you here?
Yeah.
What's the impact of your presence on Britain? You know, what impact is immigration having? He was just allowed to exist as a what was perceived as a white British person. When my mother's family had centuries of contact with Britain, Ghana was regarded as Britain's model colony.
Yeah.
My sixth great grandfather had connections to Britain. And so they came here feeling very much part of this British global family in the empire. And it's because of my mother's family that I am regarded as a second generation immigrant, that I am asked what the impact of me being here is, that I'm counted as part of this problem of immigration. And I think from childhood, I noticed that both sides of my family came from somewhere else, but one side was allowed to exist without having to answer for itself. And the other side was constantly being expected to explain why they were here. And because of that side of my heritage, I was being asked every day, where are you from? Where are you really from? Where are your parents from?
Yeah.
So it took me a long time to develop a narrative about this and how it affected me, but I definitely sensed it. And I was, and I, it's painful to say, but I was also ashamed of my Ghanaian heritage, because growing up in the 1980s and 90s in this country, it was embarrassing to be African. It was so embarrassing. Africa was the hopeless continent, the dark continent, the place of famine, war, evil dictatorship. These were the only messages that we received about Africa through the media. And having never been myself until well into my teens, I was quite dependent on these media narratives about Africa myself. So you just didn't want anything to do with it. I used to lie and tell people I was Jamaican. That was actually one of the reasons my mum took us to Ghana for the first time, because she realised that we literally did not know who we were.
You mentioned, or have mentioned in the past, that you underwent a kind of identity crisis in your youth. What did that look like? And then I suppose following on from that, I'd love to know about how it felt to leave private education and enter university, and whether that impacted how you felt about yourself.
Well, going to university was the first time I met other people like me.
Yeah.
And that was life changing. And other people like me in terms of other Black people, other mixed race people, other people of colour who had spent their lives in predominantly white environments. And I think part of the shame of these identity struggles and the self-loathing you feel when you don't have a community around you who have similar identities is that you think it's just you. It's a kind of deep imposter syndrome. You think there's something wrong with you. You think that you're a freak. You think that you have all these undesirable qualities. If only you could just look like everyone else, your family could be like everyone else. And then you realize that there are so many other people going through the exact same thing in their space. And actually, when my book came out, obviously years later, it was fascinating to me how many people came up to me and said, we were the only interracial family in the village, in the town, in the county. Yeah. And it's almost like in every little part of Britain, there is one family or a small handful of families whose children are growing up in an environment where they really, really feel visible and they don't have a community around them to make sense of it. And then they come to my book events because they finally found something they relate to. And it can be so emotional. I had no idea when I wrote my book that I was opening a space for so many people who share those experiences. And it was both really painful to realize how common that struggle is, but also really heartening to realize that increasingly it is becoming something there is a discourse around, and there are resources and stories and materials and knowledge that you can tap into to really help you that. And in my case, I think it was the self-loathing that was the most pernicious thing. And that was the thing that took the longest to overcome. Because even when I started to acquire intellectual knowledge about empire and race and British history, it takes so much longer to internalize ideas about self-love and pride in your culture.
I'm really interested in that, in what you're saying, because yes, absolutely, we can read all the books in the world, but you're still this kind of child or teenager kind of moving around your world and dealing with all this stuff that's laid upon you. Were you able, or when was the first time, I guess, you were able to look in the mirror and think, I like my face, I like things about my face? Or were you bogged down in the feelings or perceptions of others for a long time?
It was always mixed for me. Like I said, I had this joy and pride in my Ghanaian culture, but at the same time, I was embarrassed to be African. Mm. I had this appreciation for my appearance, but I was also embarrassed by it and wanted to look like everyone else. I think those things coexisted. I think having a Black mother was a big deal for me as a Black girl.
Right, so your female, your main female.
It really helped me that the woman that I most looked up to and wanted to be like was a Black woman. That gave me a kind of love for Blackness. If anything, I wished I wasn't mixed race and I was more Black like her. So that always existed. So it wasn't pure self-loathing, but I think it was the environment at the time as well. I used to read magazines. I'd read Just 17 and More, and later Marie Claire and Vogue. And there was literally no one who looked like me. I loved beauty. I loved fashion. And I was so vulnerable, as I think so many young girls and women are, to the messages about what was attractive and what was beautiful and what was valuable and what should be seen and showed off. And in my case, I just didn't fit any of the messages. You know, I was quite curvy. I was quite strong. I've always been like quite muscular. I had this hair. It's kind of 3C hair. I have brown skin. And then on top of that, I didn't even look like other black people because I have this Jewish heritage. I've got a bit of a Jewish nose. It was just this mix. I didn't really know what to make of it. And I would say it was really well into my 20s, if not my 30s, that I started to accept my appearance and not want to change it.
Was it around that time that you felt able to be more kind of playful and experimental with how you look? I know you love clothes, you love makeup. You like looking after your skin. Tell me, was that a kind of light bulb moment or did it creep up on you?
That's really recent. I've always loved beauty. My mother taught me to cleanse, tone and moisturize from a really early age and my face, and also to exfoliate and moisturize my body. That was basic.
I mean, we know this statistically that black women spend more money and more time on their skin than other women.
Yeah, I've never really thought about it, but
we know that for sure.
It was totally, I mean, that was something that we were taught as soon as we were taught how to wash ourselves and do our hair and brush our teeth. You also learned how to do that. So that was definitely always there. My mother loves clothes. It's always had a kind of small army of dressmakers that she goes to for her Ghanaian cloths or like dresses and African prints, and always took care and pride in her appearance. So I definitely learned that from her. But I think my trajectory was I was a serious person. So I went to Oxford. I worked in international development. I became a barrister. I became a journalist who focused on law and constitutions and international litigation and human rights and race. And I think my own sense of inadequacy and my own imposter syndrome drove me to feel like I had to be very serious. In a way, like, yes, I do belong in these spaces, The Guardian, the BBC and on TV, but that's because I'm very serious. And in a way, I felt like I had to overcompensate against this perception of this younger black woman. And it's super recently that I have felt permission, I guess, that I've given myself permission to also be into beauty and makeup and fashion and style and art and culture. And that required me overcoming those limiting self-beliefs, I guess, that I'm only allowed in this space because I can constantly prove that I'm intellectually capable. And I think that I've only even realized that quite recently. I don't know if I've even talked about this. So that's something that I'm now really conscious of. And now I take so much joy in talking about things like skincare and fashion, because I realize as well that it also sends a message to younger women. You don't have to have a single narrative about yourself. If you're smart, doesn't mean you can't also care about how you look. If you're into politics, doesn't mean you can't love fashion and culture. These things are all related and the categories are ridiculous anyway. But I do think as women, we often feel that we have to prove ourselves constantly, not just once, not just get the qualification or get the job or win the award, but continuously show that you deserve to be there.
This is partly why I really wanted you to come on and what I really wanted to talk about, because I'm semi-obsessed with this issue. All of the women I know are clever and read books and have opinions and are politically engaged and all of the stuff one should be, but all of them like looking nice. And I don't find that to be even remotely conflicting. Yeah. You know, I think that's really, really normal. And I've written about this my entire career. And, you know, we have seminal texts. Chimamanda has written about this at length. Yeah. The idea that intellectual women, of course, many of them also care about how they look. And I wanted to ask you that, whether you felt that female pursuits were regarded by others or were felt by others to make you a little bit less clever. And you've kind of answered that. It's such a common misconception, I think, that.
But it's real as well, in the sense that now I've given myself permission to be completely authentic about all these things I love. I still get people commenting on my feed. I don't follow you for this. I don't follow you for holidays. I follow you for anti-racism. And by the way, these are often white men. I've done this work on anti-racism, on narratives about Britishness and identity, and now you feel entitled to it.
Yeah.
And God forbid, I also would like a holiday. These are things you do as a human.
This is very familiar to me. I've always, always done current affairs stuff on the radio, and I've always written opinion columns, and there will always be a man who says, oh, great, oh, Oh, I see somebody writes about lipsticks on the sky, paper review, or, you know, whatever it is. And I always think that's such a weird and also really quite thick sort of assumption to have about people. This sort of outrage over you doing things, this perception that if you have a passion for surface, you must have no depth.
It's made me up my game in the sense that I think it's actually really useful if you care about values, you care about current affairs, you care about the crises, very existential crises we're facing in the world, that you also make that work aesthetic and attractive. And I think it's actually a useful challenge to say, how can I make this look aspirational, doing anti-racism work that you could want to see yourself. Growing up, I saw female politicians who were incredibly competent and impressive, but I didn't want to look like them. They looked kind of bedraggled.
I'd never thought of that, right? Making serious jobs aspirational, but it's absolutely true. I feel like that it was such a moment. Michelle Obama and AOC, those people, suddenly it's like, oh, that's quite a sexy, amazing, glamorous job it's those clever women are doing.
Aspirational. Yeah. And that doesn't in any way detract from the objective value of their work. In fact, it adds to it. And I think that is I think for me, Instagram has made me think more about the visual element of not my storytelling, because I work in TV and I do visual storytelling, but the story I tell about myself and my life and my work and my mission help me clarify that I can tell a story about that in a way that is also attractive. And I think, I mean, it's honest because I love looking attractive.
Yeah.
But I didn't take that seriously as part of the message. Whereas now I do. And I think that's actually enriched my life and improved my work personally.
I love that. Tell me what you do. Okay, Afua, I'm telling you now, you've got 5 minutes to get out of the door.
I never, ever scrimp on cleansing. I'm completely obsessed with the idea. I think, have good skin. I've never in my life fallen asleep with makeup on. It just feels like...
Skin and Me, our brilliant sponsor here on Beyond the Bathroom, is a subscription skincare service tailored to provide exactly what your skin needs. I can vouch personally for both the service and the treatment because I myself have been a paying Skin and Me subscriber for almost 2 years and I wouldn't be without it. It's a personalised service that's tailored for your skin. Skin and Me treats conditions like acne, rosacea and hyperpigmentation, plus it works on more general skin goals like my own. Greater glow, smoother texture, softer fine lines and wrinkles and more. Each month you'll receive a personalised dermatologist-designed solution packed with powerful, scientifically proven active ingredients you can't buy over the counter, delivered in a recyclable dispenser called the Daily Doser that you twist and click each night to deliver just the right amount of cream required for a nightly application, making sure that you get the correct dose that won't damage your skin barrier. Because Skin and Me are so confident that you'll love it as much as I do, they're offering all Beyond the Bathroom listeners the opportunity to trial their first month of Skin and Me for just £3.50 instead of at the regular cost of £24.99. That includes all the check-ins you want or need, plus reformulations and advice on tap. Skin and Me want happy, healthy skin for everyone. No dermatologist wait lists required. Just use the code SALIHUGHES, SALIHUGHES, at checkout at skinandme.com to redeem the offer. That's SALIHUGHES at skinandme.com. I was asked my guests, what's their Skin and Me moment? Like, what's the moment where they're just so content and happy in their skin?
If I can come in the door, take my clothes off, take my makeup off, put slipper socks on and then make my water bottle, nothing can faze me. I just feel so cozy and happy when I have hot water. But I'm always cold and it makes me miserable. When I'm warm, I am so happy. Very easy to please. But yes, if I've got to go out in 5 minutes, I will cleanse, tone, moisturise. And I'm okay without foundation if I have to be, but I do like a bit of under eye concealer.
Yeah.
I really feel like it lifts me a lot. I love, by the way, your skincare line, packaging, the scent. I'm into Barbara Sturm. I appreciate that she has a darker skin tone range. I think it's funny because I've heard people saying, why does she have to have a separate range? I like there being a separate range. It makes me feel seen. That I actually really like. I'm a longtime Bobbi Brown devotee. I like her foundation and under eye concealer. I've tried like the different textures and iterations over the years, but I've got like my summer color and my winter color. Summer I'm golden, winter I'm honey and warm honey. They just work so well for me. Find them easy to use, very reliable, long lasting. So that will go on. I've got this, my beautiful friend who's now the editor-in-chief at Elle, Kenya Hunt, gave me this gift of the Chanel palette with a blusher. It's like a shimmery eye color cream and a contour shade, and it's perfect for me. I also like the Glossier Cloud.
Yes, the Cloud Paint.
Cloud Paint. I might dab a bit of that on. I've got a Fenty lip gloss that I'm obsessed with at the moment that's really tingly.
It speaks exactly to what we were just saying. I have all these really, really interesting, serious, clever women in, and they start talking about makeup and they just become aglow. And we just sort of, yeah, turn into something else. It's such a funny thing. I know you love fashion too. Can you talk to me about your fashion brand?
So Seeker is a brand. I actually didn't found it. It was founded by Phyllis Taylor, one of the first contemporary made in Africa brands to do well here. When I started working in TV, I think there's so much mystique around how clothes work for people who work in TV. It's always infinitely less glamorous than you imagine. I did have a stylist, but the way it works is the stylist will like buy you a set number of pieces, which is fun. You go shopping on work time. But then I realized I'm expected to wear those pieces all the time. And I was like, but I actually want to wear other things. And I started buying all these clothes out of my own money that I just didn't feel passionate about. They didn't speak to me. They didn't invest into any communities I cared about. They weren't particularly ethical or sustainable. And so I really started thinking about, and I'm promoting these clothes on air. So I thought I would rather use this money on brands that I love, speak to my identity and my sense of style, and also feel like they're doing some good. And Seeker was a brand that I love. It's made in Ghana. It's women-owned, black-owned. It's ethical. It hires local seamstresses in Ghana, pays them a fair wage, upskills them, and also makes beautiful clothes. So I started working with Phyllis on a capsule collection. And also a lot of African designers make very big, bold statement pieces, which are beautiful, but I wanted stuff I could wear to work.
Yeah.
I didn't always want to be making a point. I started working with her on a capsule collection that was more wearable in professional environments, and it just did really well. And from then I've been working with Seeker across the brand. And it's just, again, one of those things that I do a lot of serious stuff. It can be quite draining and hard, and it's just something that gives me so much joy, is just helping design these beautiful pieces, watching the business grow, seeing women wear them and the total happiness it brings. And it's doing really well now. And that's actually really interesting because it's also a story about how hard it is to manufacture in an African country and to scale up. And I think in a way for me, like intellectually cracking that is such an important part of the things I believe in about equality and helping Africa grow.
Again, I suppose it just kind of speaks to that idea that somebody with an often very sober and sobering job would take delight in these kind of colours and fabrics. And
yeah, I think that was one of the first things I did that really said publicly, like, I'm giving myself permission to be into style and design and fashion. And that was really liberating for me. And I guess it was the perfect first way of outing myself as somebody who cares about these things, because it also has a message that I really believe in. And then since then, I've only really grown, I think, my confidence in owning that as a space that I can be in. And I think as well, as a creative person and a storyteller, you know, these are all ways of telling stories. Makeup, cosmetics, fashion, style, it's all stories that we're telling about ourselves, about the world, about our values, about our dreams. And I'm so proud of that now. And actually, I really hope that for young women listening, they realize as well that you are allowed to follow whatever pursuits you feel passionate about, and don't be judged. And these ideas about what's serious and who has the right to speak and have a view were not created by us, and they definitely weren't created for us, you know. So I see this actually as a form of liberation.
Can I ask you about tattoos?
Yeah.
So I have lots of tattoos.
I was just noticing.
I've got big ones, little ones. I've got tattoos everywhere. And I know you have views, so can you talk to me about that?
Yeah, I got my first tattoo in January. I've actually never really liked tattoos. I've always been a skin person.
Uh-huh.
This probably comes from my mother just really teaching us how to look after our skin, taking in my whole family who take so much pride. My grandmother's 95. She has the softest skin. I don't think she has a wrinkle on her face. It's actually kind of frustrating. I think I have more wrinkles than her. But in my family, it's a thing, skin. We're really proud of our skin. So I was always a bit like, oh, I don't want to do anything to like mess with my skin. I just love clean healthy skin is so nice. And then I met these women who have been curating exhibitions about the history of tattoos in Indigenous cultures. And through their work, I started to discover that my ideas about this aesthetic as like clean, pure skin, which I thought was so original and based in some kind of cultural value, were actually basically Christian missionary ideas about purity and chastity that came to the African continent and tried to encourage women who for millennia had been tattooing their bodies as a way of celebrating their beauty, connecting themselves to gods and seasons and elements, telling our ancestors that that was pagan and barbaric and savage and that they should aspire to be more pure. And these things are complete constructs. I mean, Europe has one of the oldest indigenous tattooing cultures in the world. So this kind of colonizing Christianity didn't just affect brown women, it affected everyone. And once I realized that, it just opened this chink in my mind where I started to think about all these ideas I have about my body and questioning where they come from. And I realized, because I've done quite a lot of work on my ancestry for my book, in my family, I think you have to go back to about the 1750s to find women in my lineage who celebrated their traditional tattoo and scarification practices. That's how long we've been colonized.
Yeah.
And so it suddenly became this act of reclaiming my ancestry. And also, you know, I turned 40 and I got tattooed just after I turned 40. And I started noticing that around me, women that I care about are starting to kind of fall into one of two camps. Either you're starting to think about little nips and tweaks mm-hmm. that you can do to look younger, mm-hmm. or they're starting to lean into these ways of like celebrating mm-hmm. aging and really embracing their bodies and these traditional ideas that actually aging is a beautiful and powerful thing for women. And I was like, I definitely know which side I want to choose. There's so much pressure to stay young, to look young. And it's such a specific idea that comes out of this same era of kind of European white supremacism, that this cult of youth. And it's a way of controlling women. It's a way of controlling us, making us feel bad about ourselves as we grow older, which obviously we will, as we get into our most powerful stages of life. Instead of really leaning into that power, we're busy trying to artificially propel ourselves backwards. It's such a limiting and actually oppressive idea. And I really started to see getting a tattoo as my way of marking that I rejected it fully and that I was embracing something else. So it was actually, it felt like a really powerful thing for me to do. And my tattoo is hand-poked, and I worked with this amazing artist who, that's what she does. She
so many great hand-poking artists.
Women connect with these indigenous hand-poked cultures. And it was just a completely beautiful experience. I mean, it was also quite painful because it took 9 hours. But the hand is quite delicate, obviously, and there's lots of bones. And parts like the nail bed were really, really painful.
That doesn't sound fun.
But hand-poking is so lovely because it's not as invasive. It healed really fast. It was never really like a wound. And now I love it. I think it's one of my favorite things.
There's always a degree, I think, well, there's very often a degree of reclamation. We see lots of women who've had mastectomies or something and then having a huge tattoo where their breasts were. And there are so many examples of that. There is something very freeing about it, of going, I'm just going to do this to my own body because it's mine.
I felt that. And I have to say, I was anticipating a negative response from my mother and grandmother.
And
they both liked it. Especially my grandmother, who's quite small-c conservative. I mean, she's of a certain generation. And she looked at it and she said, is it permanent? And I said, yeah. And she said, nice.
Presumably, she would have been too young to have seen it from older women when she was little.
Yes. I mean, there would have been women in, and there still are, who have traditional scarification. But nobody in my grandmother's family or social circle. And it was, again, it was kind of like under the colonial system, it was degraded. So if someone had it, you would regard them as kind of bush, you know, from some remote place, not civilized, not educated. So that's what I thought. My grandmother would still have those perceptions about it as something that, you know, you don't become an educated, successful woman to only go and drag yourself back to the village. That was what I thought it would be. And again, I think I must have underestimated her as well, and that she probably has connection to those traditional ancestral practices than I've ever actually directly seen. So I learned something from that, actually. There's what you've been taught formally, and there's what you present officially to the world, but there's also what you've inhaled.
There feels like there's a really natural arc of your relationship with your own appearance that's kind of ended with a tattoo in a way. You seem to have sort of come over in an arc shape and landed at this really powerful moment. So to finish, can I ask you what do you think now when you look in the mirror?
I wouldn't change anything about my appearance, which isn't to say I'm always thrilled with everything sure. about my appearance. Obviously, I still have my critiques, and unlearning looking at yourself and criticizing is such an important thing. For me, becoming a mother, my daughter's 11, was a big part of that, because I saw her and how unjudgmental little girls are about their appearance. All of that is learned. It comes later and
absolutely.
You start to see it filter in. And it really radicalized me about the importance of relentlessly showing her through my actions and my relationship with myself that you can love yourself and you can have a different relationship with your appearance and your body. So it helped me understand what had happened to me as a teenager in particular. I think the violence of that gaze I projected on myself and the years of damage it caused, but also that you can unlearn that and you can undo it and you can choose a different gaze. So I practice that with some intentionality now, to really gaze at myself with love and to not look in a judgmental, critical way, and also to celebrate and to not just accept my appearance, but to love it. So I do that. I work at that. I think just like leaning into a world where I love fashion and makeup and clothes helps that, because it's like I'm investing
yeah.
in my body and my appearance, hair, and making space for it and just valuing it, both through how I think, but how I live. That's been just a beautiful experience for me. So, and all the different parts of my heritage, I mean, they manifest physically in how you look, and I see them and kind of acknowledge and respect them. Yeah, and I'm, you know, as I'm kind of getting into my 40s, I think the challenge for myself is to continue doing that and not just do it as long as I feel like I look relatively young. It's so easy to say these things.
Yes, because now you're entering another form of prejudice.
Right.
It's a whole other thing. And the intersectionality between those two forms of prejudice, it's a lot.
Yeah, it's a lot. I just got sent this actually really gorgeous scent. It's for perimenopausal women, mm-hmm. to pause. And it's made with essentials and natural fragrances that are designed to balance hormones and stimulate good physical responses. Mm-hmm. To that stage of life. And when I got it, I had a bit of a like, I'm not perimenopausal. Like, you know, I still have obviously internalized some of these ideas about these things being undesirable, like almost feeling affronted.
Of course.
But the reality is, from your late 30s, you probably are getting into perimenopausal territory. And why is that bad? Why is that something to reject or shun? So it's a constant work, because we're constantly getting these messages that make aging and changing undesirable, and so you constantly have to work at choosing different ideas, and that's something that I'm very conscious of doing now.
Yes, constant work, but I'm so pleased for you that you've come so far towards that kind of self-love and self-acceptance. It's been so lovely and inspiring to talk to you. I'm so thrilled that we had you on. Afua Hirsch, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Sally. It was such a joy.
Please subscribe and follow to Beyond the Bathroom wherever you get your podcasts. And if you enjoyed the show, we'd love it if you left a rating and a review. I'll see you next time with my next guest. Bye.
Insanity Group.